Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Dave. That's Tim. And Tim.
Yes.
Halloween right around the corner. We're talking some strange stories. I've got something really bizarre that we featured last week on actually our news segment. But I wanted to just retouch on this because I've had such a weird buzz about it. And so many people have contacted me about this story. I'm going to put the links up to the story on today's episode so that people can find them a little bit easier. We reported last week on our Supernatural News program a very strange news story that had come up regarding, I guess it was a Netflix series. And two bizarre stories popped up out of that. And I thought I'd at least mention them here real quickly at the start, since we're right at the beginning of Halloween and, you know, getting into that season. Chris Watts is the focus of Netflix murder documentary American Murder.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And there is some bizarre stuff going on. First of all, in what people call a freeze frame of this, well, they actually were watching it and froze the frames. Netflix American Murder documentary, it was hugely popular and generated generated this huge storm of conspiracy theories. But one of the weird elements of this was this reported strange coincidence during which Chris Watts is questioned by the police. And a broadcast television is playing in the background. While he's speaking, it displays an image of a fetus and then rolls into what looks like a skull drenched in oil. Now, that's weird, right? But it's on TV in the background. We don't know what the commercial or the vibe of it was. But here's where it gets weird. Chris Watts stood next to the TV while police were questioning him. And as they chatted, you see the fetus, then all of a sudden a skull floating in a tank of oil appeared, which is a pretty crazy coincidence because his wife, Shannon, was pregnant. And he had put his two daughters in an oil tank.
Hmm.
So if you believe in the paranormal stuff, was it Shannon giving the cops clues, or was this just one insanely weird coincidence? You know, it's kind of creepy either way you look at it, but American Murder has been streaming for just a few weeks at the time when it began, you know, spreading like wildfire, all these strange kind of creepy coincidence and strange paranormal activity. There's also a story that came out on October 9th. It's a separate, I don't know why my mouth is not working for me today, maybe because I'm just so freaked out by this, but there's a separate viral rumor of a ghost purportedly spotted in the first 10 minutes of the documentary. Nicole Atkinson, a friend of the victim, Shannon Watts, explained that the ghost was in fact her living daughter, Madison. So that's come out because in the original context in the story we talked about last week, people believed that they caught a ghost video of one of the children that had gone missing. So there's been a lot of really strange deals. I'm going to include this story a link for the story on today's True Crime Tuesday program so people can see what I'm talking about. If you've seen this documentary, you've seen this footage, what do you make of it? I don't know. Like I said, I just thought it was an interesting slant. We have dumb crimes and stupid criminals to talk about in a little bit, but this one, so many people had been touching base with me on it. I wanted to mention it on our True Crime program as well, and it seemed to fit in as we're talking true crime and possibly a supernatural element. So very, very weird. Email me, dave@darknessradio.com. If you saw it, what do you think of it? Was it supernatural? Just a weird coincidence? But what a coincidence, right? I mean, his pregnant wife is killed, his two girls are killed, submerged in an oil tank, and there's images of a baby and a skull floating in oil.
Interesting.
Yeah, that is just, ugh. Gross. So bizarre.
Yeah. Very much so.
Let's get to today's topic. I don't want to keep our guest on hold any longer. The new book is, it just came out in August, called The Devil's Harvest, A Ruthless Killer, A Terrorized Community and Search for Justice in California's Central Valley. Joining us on today, we have Jessica Garrison. She's an investigator, investigations editor for BuzzFeed News, and spent more than a decade as a reporter at the Los Angeles Times. She is here with us to discuss the book, the case, and the horrific story that surrounds it. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jessica.
Thank you so much for having me.
This, wow, what a bizarre tale. First of all, great book. Thank you very much for getting us a copy and getting us a chance to review this. What a strange, strange story. What about this story? And I like to start off with this for our listeners just to get a better handle. What about this story in particular was something that you thought, I need to go deeper. This needs to be examined and I need to put a book out about it.
I mean, so, yeah, I think I first heard about this story when I was an editor at the LA Times. And there was a sort of a little news story that moved about a man being extradited from Alabama to California to face charges on, I think, 9 murders in California. And it was just a real short little story. And it said, you know, that police believed he was a contract killer. And then it also noted that he was from a pretty tiny little town in California's Central Valley. And I was sort of struck by that because I'd spent a fair amount of time in some of these towns in the Central Valley. And I thought, how on earth can you be a contract killer and live in one of these towns and kill people year after year and never get caught? I mean, these are tiny towns where you can't get away with, you know, stealing your neighbor's peaches. So like, you know, what's going on? And so I started looking into it and I realized pretty quickly that this was a story about an incredible crime story, but it was also an incredible story about a place. Which is a place that a lot of us don't think much about, which is California's Central Valley, but a really important place because it's where, you know, about half the food that Americans eat comes from. And wow. The more I kind of dug into it, the more kind of, you know, compelling the story became to me. And so I first wrote an article about it for BuzzFeed News. And once that article was published, even though that article was about 12,000 words, I thought, wow, I've only scratched the surface. And so then I decided to do a book.
Very cool. Let's dip into the story and introduce us to the players at hand, because this this is so bizarre. Jose Martinez, what can you tell us about his life? You know, just going back as far as you can, how do we set the stage for who this man is and was?
Well, Jose Martinez was born and raised in California's Central Valley. His grandmother had come here as a farm worker, and he grew up in this, you know, in this kind of farm worker community, and, you know, grew up around about the time that Cesar Chavez was kind of launching the farm worker movement. And he grew up, and, you know, as he tells it, he grew up kind of, you know, wanting to be a Marine and wanting to join the U.S. Army and was unable to do that. And then when he was about 16, his older sister, who he loved, was raped and murdered. And he sought, according to him, sought revenge on those who committed those murders and, you know, then became, you know, those were his kind of first murders. And then shortly thereafter, he began to commit murder for hire. And he killed, by his count, and police agree with this, about 36 people over 3 decades. And
wow.
He never got caught. And he, in fact, never got caught. But his last murder was a murder that he went to visit his daughter, who had absolutely nothing to do with any kind of life of crime, and committed a murder kind of in, you know, someone that she knew. And he was worried that she would get sort of, you know, not she was never a suspect, but he was worried that she would get a little dragged into the case. And so he confessed. And then he just kept confessing. And at first, police were like, yeah, come on. You know, a lot of people say a lot of things. And the more they looked into these cases, the more they were like, oh my goodness, we think he's telling the truth. And the remarkable thing to me, as I started looking into this, was that, you know, you I got the sort of original case reports on the original murders, but he, you know, his first murder for hire was in 1980 and his last murder was in 2013. And if you go back to 1980 and you read those original case files, one of the most chilling and remarkable things about it is that Jose Martinez's name appears in a lot of those case files. He shows up as a witness, police go to his house, and yet murder after murder after murder, he is never charged and he is never stopped.
What the hell? So his name continually pops up, but is it that it's so spread out, nobody's putting two and two together that this guy seems to be attached to so many different crimes?
Right. I mean, I think to me, the real question at the, you know, the reason that I wanted to sort of really dig into this, aside from the fact that it truly is, you know, a kind of an astonishing story, was that question. How was he allowed to get away with this? And, you know, I think that the answer, like, you know, is complicated and nuanced. But I think part of the reason he was allowed to get away with it is that, by and large, he was killing people who didn't have a lot of power, and nobody, you know, there was no big outcry when many of them died. And so, you know, another reason that I really wanted to do this book was that one of the first things I did when I started looking into it was, you know, finding the family members of the victims. And I, you know, called a lot of them up, and many of them said, you know, it just felt like no one cared. And that just kind of really hit me. This sort of feeling that, you know, your loved one could be taken from you, and then it could feel like nobody cared. And so, you know, I think in part he was committing murders in places that aren't very, you know, deeply policed. And he was killing people that, you know, there was never a big sort of, oh my God, this must be stopped outcry. And, you know, I think a third reason is that because they were, a lot of these were, you know, contract hits, when you look at the victim, you know, there's no obvious thing to connect Jose Martinez to the victim. You know, he had no personal motive for wanting a lot of these people dead.
But now, if I could reel back for a second, when you said that Jose starts showing up in case file after case file, and some he's questioned, some he's an eyewitness, was he coming forward on his own accord as a witness from time to time, or was it only when somebody pointed a finger in his direction that he would be forthcoming?
Mostly it was just nobody, I think not until very late in the game, like 2008, 2009, do people start naming him and saying, I think this guy did it. That starts to happen and police still don't charge him. But in the early cases, it's just that there's sort of a swirl of like circumstantial evidence, you know, and quite honestly, like lots and lots and lots of tips, like, a welter of tips. Who, you know, hindsight is 20/20. So like we can look back and be like, well, there it is. But his name will pop up amid 20 names. Right. And so he just sort of, you know, it's like little glimmers, little flashes of him that show up that, you know, nobody ever kind of is like, wait a minute, how come he's here and here and here and here and here? Because it's cases over many years.
Have that common thread, literally. If you tug that loose end, all of a sudden a bunch of things are going to pull together.
Literally, if you tug that loose end, what you would have is like a sort of a tapestry of circumstantial evidence. I mean, you know, I think the other thing I should note is that, you know, a lot of the murders that he committed all over the country. And so I'm really just talking about the California cases that that are in the Central Valley that he keeps popping up on.
Now, if I could ask, He starts popping up. People start pointing the finger. What is his personality like that, you know, listen, Tim and I are like brothers, best friends, brothers. We'll get on each other's nerves from time to time. And, you know, do I think he's capable of murder? Sure, we're all capable of murder. But to have somebody suddenly start pointing out, you know, I think you might want to take a look at Tim Dennis for that crime. What is he like that people start pointing a finger? I mean, is he kind of braggadocious about stuff? Is he,
no,
is he always talking about it?
Absolutely not. No. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't there. But I think, no, I mean, the sort of, the other kind of odd thing about this case is the incredible contrast between what Jose Martinez was like sort of with his family and the, you know, vicious murders that he committed.
So kind of like the Iceman, Kuklinski or whatever his name was, the Iceman. He was very, very tight family guy, but a psychopath murderer on the side.
I mean, I'm sorry to say, I don't know that case, but, he was known as kind of the fun uncle. He was the one that would like take you to Disneyland. He would take kids camping. He was like very jolly. He was the one, if you were sad, that he would be desperate to make you laugh. But he also began, you know, eventually acquired a nickname, in the areas where he lived, and that his nickname was the Black Hand. And people knew that this was his nickname. So there was sort of, you know, he had this public profile as this like very scary person. And he keeps turning up in murder case after murder case after murder case, always, I should say, in a circumstantial way. Like police never, with one big exception, which we'll talk about in a second, have actual physical evidence tying him to any of these crimes.
But let's go back to the Black Hand. You know, how does one get, you know, I might be crabby old Mr. Schrader, who's always shaking his fist at the kids for crossing his lawn, but how do you go from that to the nickname the Black Hand? And, you know, what was he doing that made him so creepy to the people around him?
I think murder for hire was what he was doing. I mean, you know, he also had another job, which is that he was a debt collector essentially people moving and selling a lot of drugs. And so if you were owed money in a drug deal, you might hire him to go and collect that debt. And
okay, so just for clarification, when you're saying he was kind of known and people were talking about him this way, it wasn't like Reverend Jacobson or the neighbor down the street was talking about him this way and calling him the Black Hand. This was people that knew what his business was and what he was doing.
I mean, it was sort of, yes, that's true, but it was also kind of just people in the community were like, oh yeah, that guy's the Black Hand. So eventually it was sort of like you could kind of wander around the street and not every single person that you asked would know him as the Black Hand. But, you know, if you asked 20 people, you might find two or three that were like, yeah.
If he was that proficient at, you know, what he did, though, how did people know who he was and what he was doing and up to?
Because these are small towns, right? In the same way that, like, you know, I grew up in a small town. I don't know if you did. You kind of know people and you're like, well, you know, I mean, in a town that I was growing up in, there was this is a very different situation, but there was a woman who was known as the Marshmallow Lady, and you could knock on her door if you were a kid and she would give you a marshmallow. And that makes it lovely, wholesome, not creepy, but like, you know what I mean? That's how small towns work. You kind of acquire this sort of folklore knowledge of people. You don't really know how you know it. That's just who they're known as. Sort of just like, you know, that. In that way, that he was known to some as the Black Hand.
All right. That just makes it to me sound like he wasn't real good at hiding what he does. Even in a small town, you would think a killer would be kind of cautious about what people know about him.
I totally agree with you, but I think, you know, there was a level of impunity here. That is part of what is the most shocking thing about this story, which is that you have a person whose nickname could be the Black Hand, who commits murder after murder after murder in California. And, you know, nobody still is able to bring charges. It's shocking. I agree. I can't explain it. That's why I wrote a book.
Yeah, that's, I'm, like I said, just trying to paint a more visceral view for our listeners of just what kind of guy this was and what kind of time and community. I mean, we all knew somebody in our town that was powerful and you didn't want to cross and mess with. But I guess if I would have known he was a killer, it's easy to say, well, I would have pointed this out. But I guess if you think this guy's a killer and he hasn't been caught for anything yet, you might be a lot more cautious than you think. You wouldn't be the renegade out blowing the whistle on a guy like that.
I really am glad you brought that up, because I think, you know, you raised the question, if you're living in this town and you've got 40, first of all, you've got 30, 40 years of history in this town of the police not protecting you, or that's how you feel. And you feel that way because when, you know, Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers started organizing to try to advocate for better conditions for farm workers, what the sheriff's department was known to have done was to come in and just beat you up. So that's sort of your starting point of the view on the police. Like, they are not on your side. And then you're living in a town, there's no police station in this town because the, you know, it's a small town and the sheriff's department is far away, and you never hear from them, and they never seem to solve any crimes, and they never seem to solve any cases, and they never actually seem to come around at all, except, you know, sometimes, but then not necessarily to make you safer. So you starting out from a position where you don't feel like you trust the police, and then you see what that occasionally this guy does get arrested and he does get brought in and the police do question him, and what happens? Nothing. And so are you really going to put your whole self and your family and your life at risk by going to the police when you don't trust them and they haven't done anything? No. Probably you're not going to do that in a million years.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, when you review it that way, it does become a lot more clear to what the community must have been feeling like. What did they, when you're looking into this, I mean, how did the community feel? Did they feel safe because they just, this guy, and I mean, safe from this guy, because they weren't his targets, his kind of, you know, what was happening? Or were they kind of all living in fear and locking their doors and windows at night and just praying that they wouldn't cross this guy?
I mean, so I think by and large, you know, I think too, like, people can kind of hear whispers that somebody, you know, there were whispers that this guy's name, you know, was the Black Hand, but like, no one knew, right? I mean, nobody was like, oh, this date, this crime, this date, this crime. It was just sort of, oh my goodness. But I also think that, like, you know, by and large, this man was very clear and kind of, you know, had said that he had a code. And his code was that, you know, he committed murders, you know, contract hits. But he also was very clear that he believed, not always with a ton of evidence, that the people he was killing had harmed the community in some way, that they were child molesters or that they were had hurt women or children. Sometimes this was true. Sometimes there was very little evidence that this was true. But I think he was pretty clear that he was, you know, only targeting people who kind of somehow, quote unquote, deserved it. Now, I'm not sure the facts support that. But I think in general, people, I don't know that they feared him specifically. They were just, you know, in these towns living in a place like it was. In these towns, there was a level of violence that's pretty hard to fathom, particularly back in the 1980s. And so I think, you know, when he was arrested, there was shock that he had, you know, confessed to so many murders. But I don't think people necessarily felt like, oh, I now feel safer.
Okay. All right. Well, as you go back in this, I mean, again, how does he sounds like he thinks he's Dexter. Right. I mean, he's taking out the trash and some of the bad guys, or at least the people he deems as a bad guy.
Right.
But I mean, he's a contract killer as well.
He was a contract killer. Yeah. But the most of his murders were for money.
How did he dip into that business? I mean, it's not like you just hang a shingle and say, you know, right? Sharp mower blades, shovel your driveway, or kill your enemy, you know, email Jose. How did he break into that?
Well, so I'm, you know, he grew up, you know, in when he was about 12 or 13, his mother married, you know, his parents were divorced and his mother married his stepfather. And his stepfather was one of the largest heroin smugglers in that era in California. And so his stepfather was just moving huge quantities of heroin, and eventually was arrested by the DEA and sent to federal prison. And, but, you know, he grew up in a milieu of, you know, pretty hardcore, pretty serious drug smugglers. And you know, those are, that's a business where people sometimes want to have other people killed. And so he got into it because, you know, I think at some point someone asked him, you know, hey, would you be willing to do this? And instead of saying, oh my goodness, absolutely not, he was like, yep, of course. And he, you know, had a you know, could do it without remorse, and could do it without getting caught. And his name got around, and, you know, before too long, he was committing murders all over the country. But they were, you know, by and large, as far as I know, drug hits. So these were people who, you know, for whatever reason, had run afoul of pretty big drug smuggling operations, and, you know, contracts were put out on them, and he would kill them.
So in a way, he was kind of this dark avenging angel. Not that I'm trying to make this guy into a hero, but it's not like he was taking out the plumber that pissed him off, or somebody who didn't give him his sixth McNugget in his box. He was going after big bad guys.
Well, like necessarily a dark avenging angel. I mean, he was going after people who, you know, he himself was from a family that was quite involved in drug smuggling, and he was going after, you know, people who owed money to drug smugglers. You know, there are, like, you know, I mean, I think we can all agree that, you know, murder is terrible, even if we also think drugs are terrible. And, you know, there's a couple murders that I know of.
I agree. I don't want you thinking I'm a nut because of what I've said. Right. I'm just saying in that version of it, he's not out killing mom and pop. He's out killing drug dealers and bad guys. And like you said, murder's bad, but in this case, it was at least people that were doing horrific things as well.
Mostly. I mean, you know, by his own admission, he did on a couple occasions kill the wrong person. So, you know, he thought he was going after one person, and at one point, you know, killed the person's brother instead by mistake. And, you know, one of the oddest murders, in my opinion, that he committed was not a drug hit. He killed someone, according to him, for the crime of parking in his driveway after he'd asked the person not to. And this is a case that is a truly kind of stunning case, I think. So, you know, Jose Martinez has a number of kids, and one of his sons was hit by a car in his own driveway when he was little. And thankfully the little boy was okay, but it absolutely terrified Jose Martinez. And so he, from that point on, decreed that nobody except his mother and his wife could park in his driveway. And a friend of his, you know, some friend of the family parked in his driveway. And so Jose Martinez said, you know, could you please not park in the driveway? And the guy was like, okay, I won't. And then he did it a second time. And Jose Martinez said, hey, I've asked you, please don't park in the driveway. And the guy was like, okay. But then he did it a third time. And on the day that he did it a third time, Jose Martinez, friendly as could be, said, hey, could you give me a ride to the store in your truck? And the guy was like, sure. So Jose Martinez got in this guy's truck with him and directed him to a store that was not in the town where he lived, but in another town a little ways over. And, you know, directed him onto some country roads past an orange grove to drive there. And at a certain point during that pleasant little drive to the store, he pulled out a gun and shot him. And then he dumped the guy's body in an orange grove. And this is where the story gets really odd. So now he's got the guy's truck. And he dumps the body and gets into the driver's seat of the truck. And it's like, uh-oh, I better, you know, wash the blood out of this truck. So he goes off to do that. And as he's doing that, he realizes that he knows a couple things. First of all, he knows it's not really the guy's truck. It belongs to his sister-in-law, who has just suffered the loss of her husband. And he thinks, oh my goodness, they are really going to need this truck. This is terrible. Like, this family, you know, can't be without their truck. So he cleans up the truck and returns it to the home of his victim's sister-in-law. That's the first completely bonkers thing. And then the family comes out, and they, at first they're like, you know, they're like, where, you know, why is our truck back? What is happening? And then they really panic because they're like, the truck is back, but you know, the victim's name is Domingo. Domingo's not here. Oh my God. And they call the police and they say, this is really crazy. We're really freaked out. Please help us. And the police come and say, you know, your story makes no sense. This is crazy. There's something you're not telling us. Are you sure you're not involved in drugs? Which is kind of their response to this family who is absolutely panicked because they've had a truck full of, you know, blood returned to their driveway. And then because Jose Martinez has dumped this body in an orange grove far out of town, it isn't found immediately. So he's living in the town knowing that he's committed this murder. And then, you know, shortly after the murder, he actually leaves town and goes off for a meeting. And when he gets back, he learns that the mother of the guy he shot is just in despair. And she's like, Martinez says, you know, my heart broke for her. And I thought of my own mother, and I thought how my own mother would think if, you know, I was missing and she didn't have the closure of knowing what had happened to me. And so he waited until about 2 a.m. and he walked out to where he dumped the body, and he kind of, you know, dug it up a little bit and moved it so that it could be found so that the mother could have closure. And when I heard this story, which it was, and then, you know, the woman had closure. When I heard this story, it just floored me, as I think it has floored a lot of people, because on the one hand, he kills someone over, you know, really, you can see it, that it's annoying for someone to park in your driveway when you've asked them not to, but I think, you know, generally we wouldn't consider it a motive for murder. But then he goes to all these steps to sort of somehow help the family of the person he's killed. It's a very odd story.
Yeah. Yeah. Did anybody ask him why he did these things? And what was his response if they did? Or was
a lot of people
he felt bad, you know? I guess you did kind of just outline it and say he felt bad because of this and wanted to make that amends. And do you think he just felt at this point that he was pretty untouchable? He'd been hit up before and never found to be a part of these crimes. What do you think was his state of mind, or what was going on with him that he just felt so untouchable?
I think he felt fairly untouchable. I think he felt like, you know, they're never going to get me. And you know, they almost never did. You know, except that, you know, he finally confessed. And then, you know, we haven't talked about this yet, but they did finally get some physical evidence against him in Florida. But even that was, you know, a little bit of a snafu by the police, because he committed a double murder in Florida in 2006. He killed a guy and an associate of his who'd been accused of stealing a couple $100,000 worth of cocaine from a drug dealer. And he murdered these guys and left their bodies in their truck, parked at the kind of, you know, edge of a swamp in Central Florida. And when police found the truck, they found a cigarette butt in a Mountain Dew can. And they, you know, took that cigarette butt and put it in a nice little plastic bag and sent it off to get tested. And for whatever reason, it never got tested. Until in 2013, a cold case detective came back to that case and was like, wait a minute, we never tested that cigarette butt. And sent it, you know, either had it the lab rerun it or had the lab run it the first time. But in any event, it hit when it was run that time on Jose Martinez. And that was the very first time that I know of that police ever had any physical evidence against him. And at first, the Florida detective, when he got that back, was like, huh, that's strange. Like, you know, didn't really think much of it. Thought, well, okay. But, you know, a low-level criminal offender from California maybe smoked a cigarette in his car. Huh, well, I'll just pick up the phone and call. So he picks up the phone and calls California, calls Tulare County Sheriff's Department, which and Kern County Sheriff's Department, which were the last agency, you know, the agencies that had arrested him the first time, and said, "Hey, what can you tell me about this guy, Jose Martinez?" And, you know, he was sort of, I don't know what he was expecting, but he sure wasn't expecting what they did say, which is, "Oh yeah, you know, he's been a suspect in about 7 murders." And this just left this Florida detective just gobsmacked. And he was like, what are they doing in California? They've had this guy as a suspect on 7 murders. And, you know, at that point, he was actually working as an informant for the Tulare County Sheriff's Department. And this Florida detective just put down the phone, just like utterly flabbergasted. He's like, what do you mean you have a murderer working as an informant? What is happening? So that is the only time there was ever physical evidence against him.
How did he end up as an informant? I mean, if they think they've got this, thought was, we've got this guy, we can't nail him, but let's use him for what he's got. Maybe he'll slip up.
I'm not sure that was, that may have been part of their thinking. You know, the way he wound up as an informant is actually, you know, to hear him tell it and to hear the Tulare County Sheriff's Department tell it, you know, he had been convicted of a couple felonies, never violent ones, you know, stealing, one, I think involving drugs and another involving stealing a very expensive tractor. And so he was a felon. And one morning he was, after he had committed, you know, the story goes like this. He goes out in 2013 to visit his daughter in Alabama. And while he's there, he just loves his children and he just adores his daughter. And his daughter was, you know, working and has, you know, these beautiful children. And he really wanted desperately to help her with her business, which was a roofing business. And she was like, you know, Dad, you cannot, because like, you're not on the insurance, like get off the roof. You cannot do this. You're not insured. No, but he really wanted to help. And so while he was there, you know, with his daughter, somebody that his daughter kind of knew a little bit loosely mentioned that somebody owed him some money. And Jose Martinez was like, well, I know a thing or two about collecting debts. And is like, you know, I'm going to help this guy collect his debt. And at the same time, I'm going to, you know, this guy knows my daughter's girlfriend and I've got some questions about my daughter's girlfriend. So I'm going to help him collect this debt. I'm going to talk to him a little bit about my daughter's boyfriend and see if I can learn a little bit. And so he gets in the car with this guy to go collect his debt. And as he's talking to him, he's like, you know, what do you think of, he gives the name of his daughter's girlfriend. And this guy, who does not know who he's talking to, makes a terrible faux pas. And he says, you know, the boyfriend's okay, but that girl he's with, she's a real blank. Talking about Jose Martinez's daughter. And Jose Martinez killed him. And because he really doesn't like it when people, he feels like threatened or speak badly of his family. So that was the motive for that last murder. And so after he commits that murder, he leaves Alabama and comes back to California. And he is worried that they're going to connect that murder to him. And so even though, you know, they question him, they don't really think he's involved at all. Comes back to California, he's living in California, and he's at his son's house. And the police show up at his son's house. And, you know, they're not there to talk to him. They're not even there actually because they think anyone in the family is involved in any criminal activity. They're there because they're worried about a series of, you know, drug stash house raids in the neighborhood. And they wonder if the family, you know, if one of Jose Martinez's sons, you know, might have any information, could talk to them about it. But Jose Martinez doesn't know any of that. All he knows is that he's just committed a murder in Alabama and that now there's a bunch of police officers at the door of his son's house. And so he kind of panics. And when he sees the police, well, I don't know if he panics, but when he sees the police, he decides to take off running through the back door. And the police do what police do when someone runs from them, which is they chase him and they catch him. And when they catch him, they also at that point find a gun in the house. And because he's, you know, a felon, he's not supposed to have guns in the house. So they bring him in on that charge, which is, you know, he's on, I think, a parole or probation at that point, and they can arrest him on for, you know, having a gun. And when he's in the car, he makes a deal. And he's like, you know, and part of the reason he makes a deal is that he's like, he definitely does not want to be locked up right now because he's worried that Alabama may get a little bit of evidence against him. And if they do, he wants to be able to flee. He doesn't want to be locked up where they could, you know, come find him easily. And so he cuts a deal with the police officer as she's driving him to the station. And he's, you know, you're looking for guns. You're looking for, like, you know, trying to get guns off the street. I could help you get some guns off the street. If you let me go and you don't violate my parole right now, I could definitely help you get some guns. And they agree. And he actually does bring them some guns. And that's how he became an informant.
This guy knew every angle. He knew how to play every angle. The Devil's Harvest, A Ruthless Killer, A Terrorized Community, and The Search for Justice in California's Central Valley. That's the book. Jessica Garrison, our guest. Again, we have a link for that book in today's program, so make sure that you get it. And then rate and review the books, folks. That's so important for all of our authors. Rate and review the books. It costs you nothing to give them 5 stars and say how great the book is, and it goes a long way to help all of these hardworking authors and researchers to get acknowledged and have their books moved up along the ranks so more and more people can find them. So as you're researching this book and looking at this, I mean, are you surprised by how big a web this guy has cast over the United States and how elusive he is?
So I think I was shocked when I first heard about the story that you could, you know, be a contract killer living in a small town and be murdering people all across the United States over 3 decades and never get caught. But I kind of knew that once I, you know, pretty early on when I started reporting this story. The thing that shocked me over and over and over again as I researched it was a slightly different thing, which is that even after he confessed and even after he said, I killed this person in this place and this person in this place, how little law enforcement in a lot of places seemed to care about closing a lot of these murders. So, you know, even today, Jose Martinez has now been convicted of 12 murders. But that leaves 24 more out there, open. And that's 24 families who don't know what happened to their brother, father, son, uncle, cousin.
Why do you think he doesn't come forward? Is he afraid that he'll get the death penalty somewhere, or?
No, he has come forward. He has. It's just that in many cases, you know, police in those towns, in those places don't, you know, for a variety of reasons, want to put, you know, go through the process of closing the cases. So he's been, in some cases, very specific. I killed these 2 people in this place, on this town, on this day. And the police will be like, yeah, well, you know, our DA isn't going to want to charge on that. You know, in some cases, because there's no physical evidence, the only person who says that he committed the murder is Jose Martinez, and that's the only evidence in the case. And so if he decides to say he didn't do it, the case will fall apart and they don't want to spend the money. Right. Like, I think in some cases they're like, you know, we don't want to spend $500,000 like flying him here and putting him on trial if he decides to change his mind, which is, you know, understandable from one perspective. But from another, there's a whole lot of families out there waiting for closure. And you've got this, you know, I mean, one of the things Jose Martinez did when he was in jail awaiting trial in Florida was he would just write these letters to detectives and say, Dear Detective So-and-so, you know, I hope this finds you well. I am Jose Martinez. You know, as you know, you questioned me about a murder like 20 years ago, and I told you I didn't do it, but guess what? I did it. And then, you know, in some cases giving extremely specific detail that only someone who was at the crime scene or, you know, knew about the crime scene would know in confessing to these murders. And for a variety of reasons, jurisdictions around the country still haven't taken him up and still haven't tried to bring closure. And I think for me, that was one of the most shocking things about this case, which is that, you know, victims who, you know, all those victims have family members who are desperate to find out, you know, whether those victims were drug dealers or not. They still all got moms who are desperate to find out what happened. And you got a killer willing to tell you, and you're still, they're still not closing them.
You think if the victims were cute little blonde white girls, there would be a prosecution as opposed to who they are?
I mean, I think that.
And I don't mean to sound so, I don't mean to sound so dismissive, but I mean, it almost sounds like, well, listen, they killed a bunch of, he killed a bunch of bad guys. He killed some drug dealers and some people that, you know, I'm just wondering if you think in the eyes of law enforcement, it's just, hey, the scum took care of itself. Let's just leave it at that. Let's not waste any more money.
And you know, I've never, in the course of this case, I have not come across a single homicide detective who didn't really want justice for all their victims. And I think that, you know, the homicide detectives in these cases worked these cases and worked them really hard. I think, you know, what you do see, and, you know, that this case provides a really interesting case study of its, of the, of exactly that point, is the institutions, the larger institutions in which these people work, the justice system, the prosecutors, the, you know, police brass. You know, you never see in these cases, I never saw a lot of pressure to bring these cases to a closure or to bring Jose Martinez to justice. And I think there's a really interesting case study, which is that there's another murderer who's working in the Central Valley around the same time as Jose Martinez. And that's a murderer you've heard of, because he's known as the Golden State Killer. And if you look at the kind of public pressure and public outcry around that case versus the public pressure and public outcry around the case of, you know, Jose Martinez, there's just no comparison. And so, you know, do I think that, you know, who the victim is can sometimes lead to more pressure to bring justice and bring closure from society and the institutions of the justice system writ large? Oh, yeah. Yes, I do.
This, you've got two killers, like you said, kind of working simultaneously in those areas. Do you think there's any cross-pollination that has Jose copped any crimes that this other, you know, that the Golden State Killer might have been involved in?
I mean,
in
the
or
Golden
no?
State. No. I mean, you know, they're not, they're sort of, they overlap in time just a little bit. But also, you know, the Golden State Killer was raped, you know, allegedly, or I guess he's been convicted, but, you know, accused of raping and murdering, I think, you know, women. Jose Martinez, you know, by his own, you know, as far as I know, has never been accused of hurting a woman. And in fact, claims the reason that he committed a lot of these crimes was, you know, whether you believe it or not, was to protect women. So they're very different types of criminals.
Did you get a chance to talk with Jose yourself?
I did.
What was that like? And, you know, I mean, again, I always find it fascinating, and I know our listeners do, to actually hear from someone who got to sit across from that person, to talk with them, whether in person or over the phone, and hear from them. What was your takeaway?
Well, I mean, I think when I started working on this, you know, I talked to a lot of homicide detectives who had interviewed Jose Martinez after he started confessing. And several of them told me the same thing, which was, you know, you'd never believe it. He seems like the nicest guy. He seems like the most personable guy. He seems like the most humble guy. You just could never really, even though you knew he was, you know, a vicious killer, you could never really wrap your head around him. He's just such a, you know, polite, pleasant person. And so I had kind of knew that about him. And then, you know, when I was working on a story, that the story that eventually became the story for BuzzFeed News about this case, you know, I wrote him a letter. And said, hi, you know, I'm a journalist, I'm writing about your case. And I've written a lot of those letters in my, you know, I've been a reporter for a long time, and I've written a lot of letters to prison, and I really wasn't expecting an answer. But, you know, some number of weeks later, my cell phone rang, and it was Jose Martinez. And he said, I got your letter. What do you want to know? And I was like, wow, well, you know, I'm writing about your case. And one of the things that, one of the questions I have is that, you know, you're kind of known for two things. Like, you're known for being, you know, an absolutely remorseless, you know, brutal murderer who has devastated the lives of, you know, numerous people whose family members you've taken from them. I mean, I don't think I quite put it like that, but, you know, and you're also known for being kind of extraordinarily loving to your family. So I'm interested in kind of how you got away with murder for so long. And I'm also kind of interested in how you can be kind of one person to your family and another person, you know, as you're committing these murders. And Jose Martinez kind of laughed a little bit, and he was like, you know, it's a long story. And I think he, you know, he kind of wanted to tell the story of his life and how he'd gotten away with that. And so, you know, I've talked on the phone to him a kind of a number of times, and I've also spoken to some of his family members. And on one occasion, I flew out to Florida and interviewed him when he was in jail there.
When you are talking to this man who has murdered people, do you get the sense that there was, obviously he showed regret in some instances. Did he, do you think he detached from the killings? It was a job and it was a crap job, but to him it's no worse than the guy that's got to mop the stalls at a porn shop or, you know, clean horrible, horrible sewage places, you know, just horrible jobs that you're like, God, this sucks, but this is what pays the bills.
You know, I think he definitely did. I think, you know, I really was very focused on, as I was doing this work, like a couple big questions. You know, the first was really the kind of, how did he get away with this? Why was he allowed to get away with this? And the second was sort of like, what kind of justice, you know, for the family members of his victims, kind of justice did they get? And, you know, I think a third question that I was really interested in was like, you know, what is the place that he is from and the milieu that he's from and his family story? And those were all the kind of questions that pulled me. I really didn't feel like I was qualified at all to evaluate like what his psychology was. You know, I mean, I just didn't think that was something I could or should do.
I understand that. I just didn't know if while you're speaking to the guy, does he, listen, I could talk to you and be excited and happy about some things, but as I get to parts that are painful, you can see it etched on my face, even though I'm trying to remain bubbly and upbeat during an interview. So I just was curious if he,
you know,
ever saw anything.
He didn't, he was never, I never saw him express remorse for these murders.
It just was what it was. When he is admitting to the rest of these crimes, you know, you said that they're afraid he might back down. He didn't back down on any of the others he copped to, correct?
Correct.
So what can people do if they live in a state where these murders took place and they want to see the law go to the full extent and that these cases get closed? Is there anything we can do?
Oh, wow. I mean, I think I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, I think he has, you know, he has said that he has committed murders that are still open in Idaho, Oregon, Washington, Georgia, Arkansas, Chicago. So that's Illinois.
And the sense that he's not Ted Bundy-ing this thing just to gain some kind of notoriety and copping to every murder.
I mean, it's possible. You know, I think he had some pretty specific, you know, there was one murder in Idaho. You know, at a certain point when I was working on this story, I thought maybe I would try to go find some of these unsolved cases. And, you know, there were some that were just, you know, there was no way, right? Because, you know, Jose Martinez often didn't know the name of the person he was murdering. He was sort of told, this is your target, and he'd go kill him. But, you know, if sometimes he just had a description and then sort of, so, or like a first name. So he couldn't, he often couldn't say like, oh, on this date I killed like this person whose birth date is this, because he didn't know. But he was pretty specific, you know, so, but there were cases where he was like, you know, in 1984, 1985, I killed somebody in Twin Falls, Idaho. And, you know, that was an example where I thought, well, there can't be that many open unsolved murders in Twin Falls, Idaho of Mexican or Mexican American men. So I called up Twin Falls and said, can you please send me your open unsolved of, you know, Mexican or Mexican American victims from that period? And, you know, we had a little tussle. And I think my, you know, lawyer talked to them too. And then eventually they produced a couple cases. And there was one case that sort of fit the description. You know, the case was, it was never solved. And it was a complicated, and, you know, it was another case where there was like a ton of tips and half the tip, you know, the very contradictory welter of information, but buried in there, there was, you know, some suggestion never proven that the victim had come from California and had come from the San Joaquin Valley. And there was some reference, although it was a little bit unclear, that the victim had at some point been accused of rape or sexual assault. And it sort of seemed to fit, you know, the dates and the pattern and everything of Jose Martinez, who had, you know, independently said, yes, I committed a murder in Twin Falls, Idaho on this date. And so, you know, I called up Jose Martinez. When the next time Jose Martinez called me, I said, you know, did you do this? And he was like, yep, that's the one. Now, you know, does that mean he did it or does that mean he's right? I don't know. But I mean, I think there are some of the cases that kind of do, you can kind of, even without the name of the victim, try to get a sense of whether he did it. You know, other cases are more difficult, right? Like he said he committed a murder in Waterloo, Idaho. I forget the year. Well, that's a pretty big city. Like you can't, or, you know, another time he said he committed a murder in Seattle. At a specific, you know, on a specific year. Well, there's just too many open unsolved cases in a place like Seattle or Chicago or Waterloo, Idaho, that you can't just go looking and try to solve it without more information.
Crazy stuff. What a weird life to own up to. What'd you say, over 32 murders he's probably involved in?
Three dozen. Yeah.
Oh, 36. Wow. And just to be so matter of fact about it. I don't understand that gene of just being able to commit murder and not have it affect you or impact you. Did he say it was hard when it started, or was it always just a job?
So, you know, I never really discussed with him what it was, you know, what his mindset was or what he thought about when he committed murders. Because I was really focused on kind of other questions. And I think I felt was just, you know, kind of such an upsetting question that wouldn't really help us get any closer to the questions that I was interested in, which is sort of, why was he allowed to get away with this?
Right. Right. Okay. I know some of them run at the mouth from many of the authors we've spoken to. I just didn't know if he was one of those that just seemed to, you know, since he was so willing to own up to what he'd done, if he gave any more insights to his case and why he was or is who he is.
No.
That's it. Yeah. Strange stuff. Well, the book, again, The Devil's Harvest, it's out and available. There's a link for it in today's program guide. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us and giving us some insight into this fascinating story and a look at this ruthless killer. I mean, it's astounding. It shouldn't be, especially after how many years we've been doing the show, to just hear how many people are capable of murder and murder in big ways. And live kind of unabated for years doing what they do. It's shocking, but I appreciate people like you digging into the story and revealing it so that more of us can be aware of what's really going on in the world around us.
Well, thank you so much.
We will leave it with that. Please get back to us when you've got your next book out. We'd love to hear more from you.
Thank you, sir.
All right, great. All right, kids, let's kick open the case files. They're teeming with stupid, stupid stories. Dumb crime, stupid criminals next, right here on True Crime Tuesday.
It's Crayon News Storytime.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
Tim.
You?
Before we begin this week's foray into dumb crime, stupid criminals, huge news.
Yeah?
Huge news,
Tim. Huge?
You know how important music is to both of us.
Oh, yeah.
How it can convey a message better than anything,
mm-hmm.
and it can help you connect with things that you might not have felt connected to before.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, the classic rock group Blue Oyster Cult, Tim, they've made a career singing of many frightful figures. Blue Oyster Cult has sung of the Grim Reaper,
mm-hmm.
Godzilla,
mm-hmm.
and imagined a nightmarish Joan Crawford rising from the grave.
Joan Crawford?
Yeah, yeah. The group released live versions of those songs in 1981, recorded at the former concert venue, the Hollywood Sportatorium, which, of course, itself is a chilling spot. But now Blue Oyster Cult has turned its eye for the macabre to arguably the most frightful figure of them all, Tim. Are you ready for this?
I believe so. I think so.
Well, Florida Man is now part of Blue Oyster Cult's pantheon of terrifying music. Florida Man serves as a tuneful and humorous highlight of the band's first studio album in almost 20 years, The Symbol Remains, which hit retailers on Friday. The song, written by lyricist and novelist John Shirley, with the group's founding member, vocalist-guitarist Donald Buck Dharma Roser, introduces listeners to characters like a Miami nurse who snatches a purse and drives in reverse down the highway. Then there's Beth, who is high on meth with a neighbor's cat on her breath, and Lee, who drives through a plate glass and blames Alice's caterpillar. They said, I wanted to write a song about the Florida Man as a folk legend, such as Pecos Pete or Paul Bunyan, Roser told the Miami Herald in an email. I also wanted to present the Florida Man as a somewhat sympathetic character. I imagine there was a reason for his behavior. And in the Blue Oyster Cult song, the story tells of an ancient Seminole curse dating back to the conquistadors. He also told the Sarasota Herald Tribune he was in Newport Richey when he came up with the idea for Florida Man, and that the whole country is on to Florida Man. So without further ado, Tim, let's just have a taste of Florida Man from Blue Oyster Cult as we lead into today's dumb crime, stupid criminals.
It's interesting.
You know, you've made it when Blue Oyster Cult comes out of retirement after 20 years and writes a song about you, Tim. Way to go, Florida Man. With that said, Tim, let us begin the madness that is Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. A South Florida man brought an AR-15 rifle and a 9mm handgun with him on his Disney World vacation. Why do you think he would do something like that, Tim?
I don't know. Why would he do something like that?
He was worried about his family's safety during the social justice protests in Central Florida. That's according to the Orange County Sheriff's Office. The 43-year-old Palm Beach Gardens man checked into the Polynesian Village Resort with his guns and a tennis bag on Saturday. And according to a newly released sheriff's incident report, they detail that the man had a concealed weapons permit, was not arrested, so the Orlando Sentinel is not identifying him. Disney stored his guns for him until the end of the trip. The bellman handling the bag to bring to the man's room wondered why it was so heavy, made the discovery and reported it to his manager, who then contacted the sheriff's office, the report said. The sheriff's office questioned the man, who told them he brought his rifle with him for their safety because of the riots and civil unrest going down in a Central Florida area, the incident report said. Protesters demonstrated regularly, including near Disney World, after a deputy fatally shot a 22-year-old Salathis Melvin outside of the Florida Mall on August 7th. And like in many cities across the nation, Orlando has had protests in support of Black Lives Matter downtown as well as near Universal and other surrounding areas throughout the summer. In addition to the guns, the man brought three rifle magazines with a total of 90 rounds and two 9mm magazines with a total of 20 rounds. The sheriff's office checked his concealed weapon permit. We then gave the man back his firearms and told him we appreciated his cooperation, the incident report said. No arrests were made because no laws were broken, the sheriff's office said Tuesday when reached for comment. Boy, that could have gone horribly wrong. This almost sounds like the beginning of that horrible Vegas shooting.
Yeah,
you go to the world's happiest place on earth, loaded for bear, and you know, you say it's because of that, but I wonder if there was just a tragedy that was averted without even knowing it.
No, I don't know. Yeah, I shudder to think. You know, our friend Big D was involved. I shouldn't say involved. He wasn't involved, but he was in the middle of that crossfire, that horrible 95 shooting over there in Vegas.
Yeah, brutal.
Yeah.
Terrifying, brutal stuff. All right. Well, Tim, Florida man is not the only predictor of insanity. There is also another contingent in Florida that must be looked at with even appreciation, Tim. A Florida woman is behind bars for allegedly attacking her 69-year-old boyfriend. Why, Tim?
Why?
Because he refused to go down in the valley, if you will.
Really?
Yeah. He refused to enjoy a box lunch, Tim.
Yeah. You don't say.
Yeah. Yeah, according to cops, Katiana Jordan, 46, was arrested following a 3 a.m. disturbance inside the Largo residence she shares with the victim, Jordan's longtime boyfriend. The man told police that he had been arguing with Jordan in reference to the defendant smoking crack. Jordan, the man charged, was high and began yelling at him to perform oral sex. The victim, however, declined Jordan's request, prompting her to allegedly begin hitting and scratching him. The man, cops noted, sustained several small lacerations, which appeared to have been caused by fingernails. A witness corroborated the victim's account of the confrontation. So they weren't just alone, Tim. It wasn't just a man and his woman, or a woman and her man, and a fight broke out over oral sex. There was somebody there that could witness this whole thing. Yeah. Yeah, because the witness corroborated the account. Pictured Jordan fled the residence before cops arrived, but she was apprehended with the aid of a canine tracking unit. Jordan claimed that she had defended herself after being choked by her boyfriend. Jordan was charged with felony domestic battery as well as grand theft for allegedly stealing the victim's cell phone. She is being held in the county jail on $12,500 bond. Court records show that Jordan's rap sheets include convictions for aggravated assault, welfare fraud, cocaine possession, battery theft, grand theft, obstruction, trespassing, marijuana possession, violating an order of protection, and possession of drug paraphernalia. Almost blacked out from that list, Tim.
Busy, busy person.
Additionally, in separate incidents, Jordan has been arrested for striking her pregnant daughter, hitting her brother-in-law in the head with a thrown iron, and smacking her boyfriend, the same man identified as the victim in the current case, with a glass vase. In all three matters, prosecutors declined to pursue charges against her. How long do you need to wait when you're beating up a pregnant woman, hitting another victim in the head with an iron, and then smacking your boyfriend with a glass vase? Maybe we need to press charges.
Yeah. I think maybe the two of them need to just not be together anymore.
Tim, you don't understand love.
I
you don't understand love, Tim. You can't break up a power like that.
Love doesn't hurt, Dave. That's not
what I've been told in music, yeah. Tim. I've been told love hurts.
No. Love never hurts. Love bleeds. On a different note, Dave, I think the other lesson we've learned here is if you go to the market and there's the clams aren't fresh, you never should partake. And I think that's the lesson that the lady needed to learn here, and you should never force it if the clams are never fresh.
Oh, stop. All right. Yeah. The theft of a man's prosthetic leg has resulted in strong arm robbery charges. Shouldn't it be weak leg armory?
Yeah.
What I did there. This one of the felons, Tim, looks like George Michael's Gone Awry.
Really?
That's all I'm going to say. It's got that Wham hair. Yeah, but the face doesn't match the hair. That's all I'm going to say.
I see.
According to investigators, Larry Stuthers, 41, accused the victim of stealing a backpack. So Stuthers and a cohort, 31-year-old Jason Rappa, allegedly confronted the man Saturday afternoon in Largo, Florida. A fight occurred between all parties, according to an arrest affidavit. And in the course of the fight, a prosthetic leg was taken from the victim. The man whose leg was stolen fled the scene and sought police assistance. Officers arrested Stuthers and Rappa about an hour later and charged each man with strong arm robbery, a felony. Stuthers and Rappa do not necessarily have an attorney at hand yet, Tim, but I don't know if the law firm of Schrader and Dennis, defense attorney at law, should step up to this one.
Yeah, we might want to pass. Yeah.
They do not, court records also don't mention if the leg has been recovered, Tim.
No. Well, yeah. That might be a problem.
Yep. Our final story in the Florida Man anthology this week, Tim. Meet George Vacherlin. The Florida man, 48, was already shackled when cops took him into custody early Monday morning following a traffic stop in Eustis, a city about 40 miles from Orlando. Vacherlin, an ex-con whose rap sheet includes multiple felony convictions, was charged with possession of ammunition by a convicted felon after cops found a Remington 22 caliber round inside his Jeep's driver door pocket. Vacherlin's male passenger, with whom he shares a home address, was busted on drug charges, and officers found methamphetamine and used syringes in his bag. According to a Eustis Police Department report, Vacherlin, who is locked up on a $10,000 bond, was placed in handcuffs that were double-locked and checked for proper fit. It's unclear whether such care was taken for Vacherlin's steel bondage collar when it was put on earlier that morning. He just looks crazy. You remember Larry, Daryl, and Daryl
on
the New York show? He looks a lot like Larry.
Really?
With a S&M collar on, if you would.
Wow.
Tim, as we sit here listening to stories of Florida man and Florida woman.
Yes.
It's easy to sit in judgment, Tim.
Yeah.
And think that they are the wackiest beings on earth. But in the immortal words of the legendary Blue Oyster Cult, Tim, we should end this segment with a little insight to this misunderstood man and woman.
Don't you laugh, it could be you. The Florida curse always comes true. You can cheer, but you don't understand. Any fragile soul can be a Florida man.
How true is that, Tim? Any fragile soul can be the Florida man. And I've got stories to prove that from all around the rest of the United States. Let's go to Louisiana for our next story, Tim, where the soul of Florida man seems to be alive and well. Have mercy on us all for this next story, Tim.
No, right.
A Louisiana priest was arrested for allegedly filming himself having sex with two dominatrices on the altar at his Catholic church.
Wow.
Yeah, the priest, identified by NOLA.com as the Reverend Travis Clark, was busted after a passerby saw the lights on later than usual on September 30th, peeked inside St. Pete's and the Roman Catholic Church in Pearl River. The unidentified witness saw the half-naked priest having sex with two women who were dressed in corsets and high-heeled boots. The altar was also adorned with stage lighting, several sex toys, and a cell phone mounted on a tripod that was recording the act. The witness took video footage of the unholy trinity before calling police, because of course, we have to videotape everything before we do what's right.
No,
for cops posterity. Arrested Clark along with his two alter servers, Tim, 41-year-old Mindy Dixon and 23-year-old Melissa Cheng, and booked them on obscenity charges. I'm curious, if the church was closed and locked, mm-hmm. and this man was having consensual adult sex, how is that obscenity? Nobody told somebody to go look in the window and videotape it.
That
could happen to anybody. You could walk up on me at any given time and find me in a compromising position at home, because I'm randy like that, Tim. But should I be arrested for that?
Yes, Dave. They're desecrating a church, and a church is a public place.
Yeah, but if the priest lives there, it's his home as well.
Well, he doesn't.
And it was closed up. It was after hours, Tim.
He doesn't live in the church. He lives in a house behind the church.
I don't know that to be true. Maybe he's like Quasimodo.
It is true. He doesn't live in the church. He lives in a house behind the church.
The woman reportedly told cops they were at the church to film role play with the priest. Cops determined everything that went on that night was consensual, but arrested the trio on the obscenity charges because they were in view of the public. Mm-hmm. NOLA.com added that Dixon, who is also an adult film actress, had posted on social media a day prior that she was traveling to New Orleans area to meet up with another dominatrix to defile a house of God. That's not good. The Archbishop of the New Orleans Archdiocese visited the church to perform a ritual that would restore the sanctity of the altar. Clark, who was ordained in 2013, was suspended. Hard to believe, Tim, but he was suspended and may not be back.
Hard to believe.
Yeah. Let's go to California, Tim. It's a place you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
So we're loading up the truck and we're moving to Beverly Hills, that is. Swimming pools and psychopaths. A Victorville man was sentenced to 3 years probation after his scheme to use consumer protection laws to steal a $13,000 Rolex watch was exposed. The Riverside Police Department shares this with us. The sentence was handed down to 23-year-old Anthony Delgado Alvarez on September 14th after he pleaded guilty to attempted grand theft. Tim. Yeah. So he's got this crazy idea of using an ID theme, or ID scheme, rather, not theme, Tim.
Okay.
This case is unique because Mr. Alvarez used identity theft and fraud protection laws to help commit his crime. The sort of reverse fraud is becoming more common and will most often raise red flags with banks and credit card companies, who then report the crime to police. As Money detailed it, Alvarez contacted his bank in June 2019 to dispute a $13,423 charge on his debit card for the purchase of a Rolex while in Las Vegas. For weeks, Alvarez challenged the charge and sought a refund. He cited the Electronics Funds Transfer Act, a federal consumer protection law that helps reimburse victims whose debit cards had been fraudulently used. He told the bank that he previously worked in payment processing and knows that security chips and PIN numbers on cards can be fraudulently duplicated. Alvarez also told the bank that his rights were being violated because his money had not been returned. But when Riverside police, after being contacted by the bank, reviewed video of the purchase, it was clear that it was Alvarez who bought the watch, Money said. The Riverside County Sheriff's District Attorney Office then filed charges against Alvarez. So if you're going to claim fraud, don't go into the store on video and buy the stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Turns out he still owes the credit card company $13,423 and still has the watch. The crime, Money said, was not the purchase, but attempting to get a refund by falsely claiming he did not buy the watch. Money said people can stay up to date on various types of fraud and scams by visiting the FBI's website at FBI.gov, Tim. You down with GOV?
Yeah, you know me.
Our final story, Tim. Final story. She said it was fun. A 31-year-old Riverside woman arrested after allegedly taking a fire truck on a joyride. California. The other white meat, Tim. The other Florida white meat. A woman was arrested Thursday night for allegedly stealing a Riverside Fire Department truck and taking it on a joyride while first responders were handling a life-threatening medical emergency. Two police officers responded first, then began CPR, Riverside Police Sergeant Juan Munoz said. They saved the man's life. Munoz said that while firefighters were getting the victim, who had stopped breathing, into an ambulance, the suspect hopped inside their engine at Hole Avenue and drove it 3 miles away to the eastbound Adams Street off-ramp on 91 Freeway, colliding with at least two other cars along the way, Tim.
Oof.
She was eastbound and down, loaded up and trucking. When the engine came to a stop at the off-ramp, officers said the woman attempted to get into at least two other cars. She said, it was fun. And I know it's going to be hard to believe, Tim. She appeared to be extremely intoxicated.
Get out of here.
Uh-huh. But it was anything but fun for the on-duty Station 8 firefighters when they realized their rig was missing. We just walked out to the engine, one of the firefighters said while reporting the incident, and our engine was gone. The engine weighs tens of thousands of pounds, and Muniz said was also full of water, given the potential with the weight of that vehicle and how she even knew how to start it. I'm astonished that nobody else was injured. Police said the woman had a felony warrant for narcotics. She is expected to face charges of driving under the influence, vehicle theft, and hit and run. Oh, California woman, what is up with you? So there you have it, Tim. It's Blue Oyster Cult. It's Florida man and woman and California man and woman rounding out this week's dumb crimes and stupid criminals.
Huh.
Crazy. It's a crazy world. Remember, folks, if you have dumb crimes and stupid criminals in your own area, you can email me your stories at dave@darknessradio.com. Maybe you were once a dumb crime or stupid criminal and you'd like to share your personal encounter of what stupid thing you've done. We can let you remain anonymous. You just have to say, please let me remain anonymous. But you can email dave@darknessradio.com. Tell us your dumb crime, and we may share it on an upcoming episode. That's it for this week's True Crime Tuesday. I'm Dave. That's Tim. Remember to tune in to the best in paranormal talk radio Wednesdays and Thursdays as we host Darkness Radio every Tuesday. You can find us right here at True Crime Tuesday.